Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are unpacking a corner of American jurisdiction that is, I mean, it's so legally peculiar, so historically complex, that it really forces you to rethink what it means to be an American citizen.
Or maybe, more accurately, what it means not to be one.
Right, while still being, you know, intensely loyal to the American flag.
It's one of those topics that just exposes the deep contradictions in how the U.S. governs.
Yeah.
And the core fact, the one that I think just stops people in their tracks, is this.
Yeah.
The United States controls a permanently inhabited territory, American Samoa, where the people born there are not automatically American citizens.
They're not. They are, by law, U.S. nationals.
That's the term, U.S. nationals.
And when you hear that, you might think, okay, it's just bureaucratic semantics, right? A different word for basically the same thing.
But it's not. Not at all.
The distinction, national versus citizen, is just, it's monumental. It carves out this strange legal gray zone that affects literally everything.
Yeah.
From voting rights to who can own land.
That's exactly right. Legally speaking, a U.S. national, they have the right to live and work anywhere in the United States.
Okay, so no visa, no green card needed.
None. They're not subject to immigration quotas or anything like that.
Yeah.
But, and this is the absolute core of the issue, they do not possess birthright citizenship under the 14th Amendment.
So if they want to become a full U.S. citizen,
they have to go through a formal naturalization process. They have to swear an oath of allegiance, just as if they were coming from, say, France or Japan.
Wow. So they're treated as legally separate from the U.S. for the purpose of citizenship, even though they're born on U.S. soil.
It's a deep structural asymmetry, and that's really our mission for this deep dive.
Exactly. We are going to examine the sources that detail how American Samoa became the only permanently inhabited unorganized U.S. territory.
And why that status still exists today, despite, you know, a lot of resistance over the years.
And of course, what practical disadvantages this creates for the people there. People our sources call non-citizen patriots.
It's such a powerful phrase. And you have to understand, this whole situation is this unique three-way tension between Washington, D.C., the local population, and really the ghosts of old school geopolitics.
Okay, let's unpack this. We have to start at the beginning. How did the U.S. even end up controlling these small Pacific islands?
To set the stage, you have to go all the way back to the early 18th century.
Okay.
The Samoan Islands were first visited by Western explorers, but it wasn't exactly a friendly welcome. Local tribes were often very resistant to outsiders.
But there was something there the West wanted.
There was. Strategically, the islands, and specifically this deep, sheltered harbor of Pago Pago on the island of Tutuila, were invaluable.
So it wasn't just about, you know, finding a tropical paradise. This was a strategic piece on the global chessboard.
100%. For trade and for the military. Hmm. Pago Pago became this prized coaling station.
Yeah.
A refueling stop for American and European ships on those incredibly long voyages across the Pacific.
A gas station in the middle of the ocean.
That's a great way to put it. And as U.S. influence grew in the mid-19th century, their interest just solidified. But they quickly found out they weren't the only ones interested.
And who was the main rival here?
Imperial Germany.
Yeah.
Starting in the late 19th century, tensions were simmering. I mean, really intensely, between the U.S. and Germany over who would get ultimate control.
And Britain was in the mix too, right?
Britain was there, absolutely.
Well,
all three nations recognized the immense strategic value of having a naval base right there, midway between Asia, Australia, and the Americas. It was prime real estate.
And the sources describe this as more than just, you know, some diplomatic tension. It almost came to a head militarily.
It absolutely did. The tension escalated to the point where in 1889, German, British, and American warships were literally facing off against each other in Apia Harbor in what is now independent Samoa.
Wow.
And the only thing that stopped a potential battle was a massive typhoon. A massive storm swept in, wrecked most of the ships, and basically forced a temporary truce. But that rivalry, it didn't just disappear. It just moved back into the embassies and state departments.
So a diplomatic solution had to be found to prevent an actual war between these major powers over a tiny island chain.
Which led, 10 years later, to the formal settlement, the 1899 Tripartite Convention.
And this is the foundational document. This is what sets up the current political reality.
It's the absolute foundation. The agreement settled the whole dispute, and it established the boundaries that we still see on the map today.
Okay, so how did they carve it up?
It was pretty clean split, actually. Imperial Germany took control of the larger Western islands. Those would eventually become the independent nation of Samoa.
And the U.S.?
The U.S. got complete control of the smaller eastern islands. That included Tutuila, with a key harbor, Pago Pago, and the Niue Islands group.
What about Britain? What did they get out of this?
Britain relinquished all their rights in Samoa. But this wasn't, you know, some altruistic move.
I figured.
They got significant concessions from Germany in other parts of the world, specifically in the Solomon Islands and parts of West Africa. It was a global trade-off.
So by the end of 1899, the U.S. is the sole ruler of the eastern Samoan Islands, and they move in right away under naval control.
Immediately. The U.S. Navy established what they called U.S. Naval Station Tutuile, and this early governance was direct, often very paternalistic.
And they technically got their claim through deeds from local chiefs.
They did, but it was very much a military-run operation. They formalized the system, which officially became American Samoa in 1911, but the American presence was heavy-handed. It influenced and sometimes, you know, forcefully suppressed local political life.
And this brings us to a really crucial point in the sources, the suppression of the Mau movement.
Yes. The Mau movement, it means something like firm opinion or witness, was a pro-independence movement. It popped up in both German and later American Samoa.
And how did the Navy handle that?
In American Samoa, the Navy viewed any local pushback against their rule as disloyalty, a threat to order.
So they shut it down.
They actively suppressed the movement. They made sure that American sovereignty was completely unchallenged.
So this whole period, this long stretch of direct top-down naval rule with no real say from Congress, no organic act, that really set the stage for the bizarre legal status we see today.
It did. You have a strategic military asset acquired through geopolitical maneuvering, governed directly by the Navy for decades, and actively resisting local political movements. That history of control, without full democratic inclusion, translates directly into the legal structure they have now.
Okay, this is where the legal jargon becomes absolutely essential. And it's probably where the biggest shock for a mainland American lies. American Samoa is not just an unincorporated U.S. territory.
Right.
It's also the only permanently inhabited, unorganized U.S. territory. We have to break those two terms down. Let's start with unincorporated.
Unincorporated is the legal foundation for why its residents are nationals and not citizens. The whole idea comes from these infamous Supreme Court rulings from the early 1900s. They're known as the Insular Cases.
Right, the Insular Cases. Deeply controversial, even today, and they still dictate all of U.S. territorial law. What did they actually establish?
In simple terms, they established the doctrine that the Constitution does not follow the flag automatically.
Meaning?
Meaning, just because the U.S. flag flies over a territory, it doesn't mean the entire U.S. Constitution applies there.
So there are different types of territories.
Exactly. In an incorporated territory, one that's destined for eventual statehood, the Constitution applies in full. But in an unincorporated territory, like American Samoa or Puerto Rico, only what the court called fundamental constitutional rights apply.
And what's considered fundamental?
Things like, you know, freedom of speech, due process, habeas corpus. But other rights, like the right to a jury trial in all civil cases, or, crucially, birthright citizenship. Those do not automatically apply. Congress has to explicitly extend them.
So the Insular Cases created the legal possibility of having U.S. nationals who are not U.S. citizens. This explains the lack of birthright citizenship.
Precisely. The court decided these territories were appurtenant to the U.S., but not fully a part of it. It's a very strange distinction.
Okay, so that's unincorporated. Now add the second layer, unorganized.
Right. So when a territory is organized, it means Congress has passed an official organic act for it.
And an organic act is basically like a mini constitution for the territory.
That's a perfect way to describe it. It's the territory's founding charter. It provides a stable framework for the local government. It specifies which federal laws apply. And it clearly lays out the relationship with Washington, D.C.
And American Samoa does not have one.
Correct. Congress has never passed an organic act for American Samoa. The sources note there have been attempts, especially from the Department of the Interior, but they've always faced this mixed reception, including significant resistance from locals, which we'll get into.
Because Congress failed to act, a huge legal vacuum was created.
It was. And in the American legal system, when Congress doesn't act on something like this, who steps in?
The executive branch. The president.
Exactly. And this leads to the most profound consequence of this status. American Samoa is under the total unilateral control of the U.S. president.
I mean, when you say total unilateral control, that sounds like something from another era.
It is. We can trace it explicitly. The 1929 Ratification Act was key. It formally vested all civil, judicial, and military powers in the President of the United States.
All powers. That is a staggering amount of centralized authority over a population.
It's absolute authority, legally speaking. Now, in practice, the president rarely exercises that power personally. But that power was delegated.
Delegated to whom?
In 1951, President Harry Truman issued Executive Order 10264. And that order delegated all of those immense powers, the power to run the government, the courts, the whole show, to the Secretary of the Interior.
Like a cabinet member, an appointed official.
An appointed official. And that's the legal structure that stands today. The Secretary of the Interior functions as the ultimate authority, almost like an appointed viceroy, with the president holding the final trump card.
So, just so I'm clear on this, if I'm a resident of American Samoa today, my local government, my legislature, my constitution, it only exists because an appointed federal official in Washington, D.C. allows it to.
That is the fragile reality of it. The territory does have a local constitution. It established their legislature, called the FONO, back in 1967.
Okay.
But, and this is the part you have to hear, it only exists because it was promulgated. That's the legal term.
Yeah.
It was authorized and decreed into existence by the Secretary of the Interior at the time, Fred Seaton.
That single word, promulgated, changes everything. It's not sovereign self-governance. It's permitted self-governance.
It is. And the implication for you, the listener, is just staggering. The president or their delegate, the Secretary of the Interior, could in theory unilaterally dissolve the FONO. They could dismiss all local laws. They could even dissolve the Constitution itself.
Just by revoking the authority they granted decades ago.
The stroke of a pen.
Has this power ever actually been used? I mean, has a secretary ever stepped in and just overturned a major decision by the FONO?
Well, a dramatic direct intervention is rare. Washington generally prefers a hands-off appearance.
Right.
But the threat is always there. And the power has been used in more subtle ways. Historically, during the naval period and right after the 1951 transfer, the secretary and their appointed governors had sweeping authority over budgets and appointments. Even today, any amendments to the local constitution often require the secretary's approval.
So D.C. can basically filter the evolution of their local democracy.
It's less a sword hanging over their heads and more of a structural ceiling on their autonomy. It's always there.
And this brings us right back to the fundamental political injustice. The people who live under the system, these U.S. nationals,
yeah,
they cannot vote for the president who legally holds absolute unilateral power over their entire system of government.
It's the ultimate democratic disconnect. They are subject to a political fate determined by an office they have absolutely no electoral mechanism to influence.
And the most incredible part of this story is that this system only persists because, paradoxically, many people on the island have actively resisted efforts to change it.
Exactly. And that resistance takes us to the absolute core of this cultural and legal crossroads.
This is the part of the story that really explains why this bizarre legal status isn't just a federal imposition, it's a negotiation. In a lot of ways, it's a local choice.
It is. Attempts by Washington to fully incorporate the territory, to grant automatic citizenship, to fully integrate them, they've been met with very strong resistance by local leaders.
And that's the big question. Why? Why reject guaranteed American citizenship? For most people around the world, that's the ultimate prize. What are they trying to protect that is worth that kind of political sacrifice?
They are protecting their deepest, most fundamental systems of local custom and social organization. It's known broadly as Fa Samoa.
Fa Samoa, the Samoan way of life.
The Samoan way, and specifically the political structure, which is called Famatai. And you have to understand, these aren't just, you know, quaint traditions like wearing certain clothes on holidays.
This is the operating system for their society.
It's the entire operating system. Mm-hmm. It dictates political organization, social hierarchy, how wealth is distributed, and most crucially, who owns the land.
So this system, Famatai, it operates as a parallel structure of authority to their modern legislature, the FONO.
Very much so. It's the chief system. Society is structured around extended family units. They're called Aiga.
Okay.
Each Aiga is headed by Matai, a chief. And that Matai holds authority over the family's communal property. They resolve disputes, and they represent the family on the village council.
So it's a highly localized, community-based system of governance.
It is. And it's endured for centuries. The titles aren't just inherited either. They're bestowed based on service and lineage and consensus within the family.
So where's the conflict? Where does this ancient system run into American law?
The conflict is that Fa Samoa dictates policies that would be fundamentally, legally inconsistent with the full application of the U.S. Constitution. Specifically, the 14th Amendment's guarantees of equal protection and due process.
Okay, let's get specific. Give us an example. What's a law in American Samoa right now that, if they were fully incorporated, would be immediately challenged and almost certainly struck down by a U.S. federal court?
The property ownership laws.
Without
a doubt.
The land.
It always comes back to the land. Local law in American Samoa dictates that roughly 90% of the land is communal land. It's held by the Matai in trust for the Aiga. And these laws have strict requirements that only ethnic Samoans can own this communal land, or even hold a Matai title.
And there it is.
There's the constitutional friction point.
Because if the territory were fully incorporated, if the 14th Amendment applied in full, those laws which explicitly use ethnicity to determine property rights and political standing would absolutely violate the Equal Protection Clause.
Immediately. The Equal Protection Clause guarantees that all persons are treated equally under the law, regardless of race or national origin. Full constitutional application would mean that any U.S. citizen from anywhere could buy communal land.
And local leaders see that as a direct existential threat to their entire way of life.
To Fa Samoa, absolutely. Because communal land is the physical foundation of the culture. To save the land, they feel they have to maintain this legal separation from the U.S.
So this strange status national, not citizen, unincorporated, unorganized, it acts as a kind of cultural firewall. It protects them from the full force of American individual rights law.
It does. It is a conscious, if difficult, trade-off. They accept the political vulnerability of being under presidential control, and they accept the lack of full citizenship rights in order to preserve the cultural and social stability that is rooted in their land and their traditions.
This very nuanced position is articulated perfectly by the territory's delegate in Congress, Amata Amua Coleman Radowagon. What is her official stance on this?
Delegate Radowagon is strongly and vocally opposed to the automatic compulsory extension of U.S. citizenship.
She's against it.
She argues that American Samoans must have the choice. Forcing citizenship on them, she believes, would be seen as an act of cultural imperialism. It would erase their ability to self-determine their core traditions and especially their land tenure systems.
So if she is against automatic citizenship, what is she pushing for? What's the alternative?
Her focus is really on reducing the bureaucratic burden for those who do choose to become citizens. She suggests simplifying the naturalization process for U.S. nationals, make it easier, cheaper, more streamlined than it is for, say, a green card holder from a foreign country.
So fix the practical problems without forcing the cultural change.
That's the idea. She's trying to resolve the disadvantages of the status quo without blowing up the cultural firewall.
So what this all means is that this situation, which sounds so precarious and frankly unfair from a mainland democratic perspective, for many on the island, it's a necessary happy medium.
It's a very complex conclusion, but yes, the status quo gives them the protective umbrella of the U.S. military, economic stability, and unrestricted access to the mainland for work and education.
While at the same time,
it maintains just enough legal distance to preserve those property laws that would otherwise be obliterated by the 14th Amendment. They are choosing cultural sovereignty over full political integration. It's a truly unique position within the entire American system.
A high-stakes cultural negotiation that I think most Americans are completely unaware is even happening. But making that choice, it comes with massive practical disadvantages.
It does, which brings us back full circle to the consequences.
We have to talk about what it costs them. Lacking a vote for the president, lacking a voting representative in Congress, it means American Samoans bear the consequences of federal decisions without any real electoral input.
And that leads to what is maybe the most profound and frankly, moving paradox that we uncovered in the sources.
The non-citizen patriots.
The loyalty and commitment of American Samoans to the U.S. military is. It's just astonishing.
What do the numbers say?
Statistically, American Samoa stands as the number one U.S. jurisdiction in terms of military recruitment per capita.
Wait, say that again. Number one?
Number one. They rank above every single state. Above Puerto Rico, above Guam, they send proportionally more of their young men and women into the armed forces than any other place under the U.S. flag.
Let's just sit with that for a second. A territory whose people are illegally defined as non-citizens, who cannot vote for their commander-in-chief,
Who is also their ultimate governor.
is the most loyal supplier of troops to the U.S. military. That's incredible.
And the sources point out the tragic side of that statistic. The disproportionate casualty rates American Samoa suffers. Every decision made in Washington to go to war, to deploy troops, it hits that small island community harder than almost anywhere else.
They pay the ultimate price of citizenship.
While being denied its most fundamental rights, it's an overwhelming expression of patriotism met with a denial of political reciprocity.
And this huge sacrifice contrasts so sharply with the smaller but constant legal hurdles they face just because they are nationals and not citizens.
Absolutely. Even just with documentation, a U.S. national passport looks a lot like a U.S. citizen passport, and it grants the same freedom of movement.
But there are differences.
There are subtle but important differences. For example, it affects children born to nationals outside of the U.S. If a U.S. citizen has a child overseas, transmitting citizenship is usually pretty straightforward.
And for a U.S. national?
It's more complex, more restrictive. It can depend on how long the parent lived on the island. It just highlights this tiered system of American identity.
What about voting? If a U.S. national moves to, say, California, can they register and vote in federal elections there?
No. Even once they establish residency on the mainland, they cannot vote for president, vice president, or Congress until they complete that formal naturalization process and become a full citizen.
So they're caught in this bizarre legal limbo. Less than a citizen, but way more integrated than any foreign resident.
Exactly. Now, let's pivot to the last piece of this puzzle, which is the unique anomaly of American Samoa's immigration status. Because this is where the implications of being unorganized and unincorporated get truly wild.
Okay.
This is one of the strangest administrative details in the entire U.S. sphere. Of all the permanently inhabited unincorporated territories, Puerto Rico, Guam, the U.S. Virgin Islands, American Samoa is the only one that controls its own immigration system.
The federal government, Homeland Security, does not manage their borders.
That's correct. The American Samoan territorial government issues its own entry permits. They set their own requirements for foreign nationals who want to live there.
And I'm guessing this goes back to protecting Fa'asamoa.
It's all connected. They want to control who settles there, who integrates, and who might try to challenge local customs in court.
But this local control over immigration, it creates a disastrous, unforeseen consequence for some people moving there from the mainland.
It creates a huge counterintuitive legal risk for U.S. legal permanent residents, green card holders.
Why?
Because American Samoa is the only major jurisdiction under the U.S. flag that is not legally considered a state for the purposes of federal immigration law.
And why is that distinction so critical for a green card holder?
Because your U.S. permanent residency status requires you to maintain your intent to reside permanently in the United States. Federal regulations say that residing permanently outside the U.S. can be considered an abandonment of your green card.
Okay.
Since American Samoa controls its own immigration and is legally outside the states for this specific purpose, a U.S. legal permanent resident who moves there to live can technically be judged to have abandoned their permanent legal residence in the U.S.
You have got to be kidding me. So someone with a green card moves from New York to Pago Pago, from one part of the U.S. to another. And they risk losing their ability to come back to the mainland permanently.
That's the risk. It's an absolute failure of legal translation between federal jurisdictions.
That is shocking. And it just powerfully reinforces this idea of American Samoa as this complete outlier, the last of the last, as the sources say.
It highlights just how sharp that legal line is between this unorganized territory and the rest of the nation. The moment that green card holder decides to reside there, they're stepping outside of the established federal immigration zone, even though they're still under the ultimate authority of a U.S. cabinet secretary.
Yeah.
It's a mind-bending contradiction.
The layers here are just almost overwhelming. You have a population that sacrifices everything for the nation, but whose local stability depends on maintaining a legal status that denies them full citizenship and subjects them to, essentially, an executive dictatorship.
They face a constant, unavoidable choice between two very valuable things: cultural survival rooted in the land, or full democratic rights guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution. It's a fundamental conflict of values.
So if we synthesize all of this,
the American Samoan experience is this powerful, modern case study of American territorial rule. We've seen they are simultaneously beneficiaries, they're protected by the military, they have unique economic access, while also being subject to an ultimate executive authority that operates completely outside any democratic oversight they can participate in.
And the price of protecting FOSS Samoa is this profound political vulnerability.
Maintained in part by that controversial insular cases doctrine from more than a century ago.
So the key takeaways for you, the listener, are crystal clear. American Samoa is unincorporated, it's unorganized, and its residents are nationals, not citizens.
And that structure is upheld, partly because of a fierce local commitment to protecting core customs, especially FOSS Samoa and the communal property laws that keep ancestral land in the hands of ethnic Samoans.
But that cultural firewall results in these profound political and practical disadvantages. Most tragically, the fact that they cannot vote for the president who legally holds the power to dissolve their entire government.
And we can't forget the paradox of the non-citizen patriots, serving the nation at the highest per capita rate, accepting disproportionate casualty risks for a government they cannot elect.
The sources really paint this picture of American Samoa as a living anomaly within the American system. And it raises a final provocative thought that we have to leave you with.
Yeah.
What does it truly mean to be a patriot? To be willing to risk your life and the lives of your children for a country when the leader of that country wields absolute unilateral power over your home, but for whom you cannot cast a single vote?
It's a challenge to the very definition of loyalty, of citizenship, of democratic inclusion in the 21st century. And it's happening right now under the U.S. flag. It forces us to ask where the boundaries of self-determination really lie and whether cultural sovereignty can ever be fully achieved without sacrificing democratic rights.
That is the deepest dive we can take today. Thank you for joining us.